This is part six of the oral history with Tom Zinn and Harold Kerr. Do you have any travel stories you want to talk to us about?
Me?
Either one.
As we both look at each other.
Well, I'll throw one out just for the heck of it. When I was in Gillum County, I talked about the home economist who had been there. Great home economist, very professional. Her husband was getting a PhD, and he just had about finished, and she announced that she wasn't going to be there much longer. And so I kind of panicked, thinking, oh boy, who am I going to get now to help me out? And she did agree to come back a couple times and finish some work that she had started. And at one time we were traveling on a rocky road. I had a Nash Rambler, which was a state car, and I didn't know her all that well because she hadn't been there in the county very long. But I knew her well enough to know that she was very well respected by clientele and very good at what she did. And so we were driving down this road going to a rancher's house to meet the wife, I think, and I asked her if she ever had pheasants. She said no. I said, you ever cook a pheasant? She said no. And I said, all right, there's one going to run across the road, and I think we can get it. And so I just centered on that pheasant, and sure enough, the front axle hit the pheasant right in the head, and I jumped out and threw it in the trunk. And she looked at me. She says, I cannot believe you. She said, what are you going to do with that bird? And I said, well, you said you'd never cooked one. You've never eaten one. So I said, this is going to be your chance. You're a home economist, so I'm challenging you here a little bit. So we did our job and got home. And so I said, well, I'll take the pheasant to the house and pick it. And then you can cook it. And so I picked it, and I think my wife was gone to the Dalles or something. She had gone somewhere. She wasn't home at the time we brought the pheasant in. And anyway, cleaned the pheasant up and everything, cut it up, and so I said, well, fry it. She says, I've never cooked a pheasant in my life. I said, you ever fry a chicken? And she said, yeah. I said, well, fry it like a chicken. And so anyway, she cooked the pheasant, and about that time my wife came home with the kids, and she says, what's going on? I said, well, we're having pheasant tonight. And the home economist said, your husband's crazy. She said, he asked me if I ever eaten pheasant, and I said no, and then he ran over one. He says, well, you're going to eat one. There's a lot of stories like that that we could tell, but I'm not sure we want to. Harold, you probably have one.
Well, I have one that we haven't talked about. Okay. When I was in Prineville, the home economist's name was Maud Pervine, and she was in her 25th year or more of extension work, was one of the real veterans of the home ec field. And at one point in her career, she'd been in Wheeler County. And there are a lot of dirt roads in Wheeler County, particularly, well, anytime you left the county seat of Fossil, most of the roads were gravel and dirt. And she was going south to Mitchell and passed one of the county commissioners in her state car. And as she went by him, her gas tank fell out from under the car and tumbled down the road, and the county commissioner stopped and picked it up and then took off after Maud and chased her quite a while before this state car ran out of gas. It finally started to cough and spit and died, and he drove up behind and says, Maud, he says, are you okay? And she says, yes, but my car died. And he said, well, I think I know why. I've got the gas tank in my trunk. So Maud was quite a character. That she had worked all over the state, and she was a real, I always got a little upset with her because she always wanted to plan. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of our 4-H things. She was in charge of the home ec part of 4-H, and we'd have these planning meetings, and we'd decide what everybody was going to do, and then when the event would come, well, Maud wouldn't be there, and she'd agreed to be part of the program, and I got so frustrated with that. And I'd say, Maud, weren't you supposed to be there yesterday? Oh, she said, I was busy planning that March meeting. She's a great gal, but I always, when she agreed to do something, I had better be prepared to do it because she was going to be busy planning the next session. Now, the other road stories, I think, we'll save for the centennial.
Okay.
Is there a centennial?
Could be.
You're not going to tell a waterbed story.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
You just perk Sue's interest on the waterbed story.
She probably knows it.
Well, Harold, could you talk a little bit about your trips to Lithuania and how that came about?
Okay.
How they came about.
I retired in 1990 and heard about, actually I was working for Stalbush Farms, which is a local vegetable grower farm, and I'd gone to a food convention with them and had met a young man in a booth called VOCA, V-O-C-A, Volunteers for Overseas Cooperative Assistance. And I just was visiting with him about what that program was all about. And he explained that started by the Midwest co-ops, and they were sending agriculture people to third world countries mostly to help them get various agriculture projects started. And I said, well, that sounds interesting. And so I took a form and filled it out and sent it in. And 6 months later was called by a VOCA representative, said they were needed somebody to go to Lithuania. They had just gotten their independence from the Soviet Union within 2 weeks at that point in time. And he said, we have some funding from the European Economic Community, and we want to start an extension service in Lithuania. And we'd like to have you go over there as our contact person. And so I thought, well, that sounds neat. So I signed up, did it, and got my tickets and took off for Vilnius, Lithuania. Arrived there 30 days after they'd gotten their freedom from the Soviet Union. And one of the scary parts about landing was that this runway, which was in very poor condition, was lined with World War II Soviet fighter pilots, fighter planes. And that was a little bit scary. And anyhow, we taxied up to this building and walked down a ramp to the sidewalk and then into this building. There were no lights in the building at all. It was dark. Finally, you could figure out where you were, and suitcases started tumbling out of this hole in the wall. And my suitcase showed up, and so I walked through this mass of people. Should say that the plane from Copenhagen to Vilnius was a Lithuanian plane, and it was just jammed with Lithuanians going back to their home country for the first time in 30 years that they'd been able to go there. Mm-hmm. And so it was just jammed, and the conversation was all in Lithuanian. So it was like you were in a foreign country while you're still on the plane. Anyhow, when I walked out into this larger room that had a few lights, I saw this VOCA sign this young lady was holding up, and that was a big relief. Turned out she was a secretary to the local VOCA representative, who was a Lithuanian. And I traveled, met my counterpart, which was the director of extension that they had hired, and really neat guy, Edvardas Mikailis, and we traveled over Lithuania and talked about extension and how it worked in the U.S. and what his people could do. And anyhow, we had a great time and a great relationship. And so I went back twice more, once with Bob Smith and Glenn Klein, to teach their new faculty about extension methods. And Glenn was our principal teacher, but Bob and I helped a little bit, but Glenn did most of the teaching. And then Bob and I went back a third time to evaluate how they were doing. And I don't think an extension service exists now, because it only had 3 years funding and they just didn't have any money to fund something like that from their local government. But it was a great experience, and one I've will treasure for the rest of my life.
Okay. So when did you retire?
September 30th, 1990.
1990, and Tom?
October 30th, 1993.
93, so
3 years later, yeah.
Okay.
I found out after I'd retired that I really wasn't employed on October 1st. I was employed on October 10th, and I was really 10 days short of 30 years, but I got credit for my unused sick leave, so I was able to get my 30 years in.
So when you look back on your careers, and especially in the last portion when you were in Corvallis, what are some of the major changes that you saw in the extension service?
Well, before I got to Corvallis, I would say that I was told by I don't know how many people, Elizabeth, that the best job in extension is a county faculty member. And I was told that when I first went to work, and And I suppose if you're looking at extension after you're hired, shortly after you're hired, and you look at the supervisor, associate director, something, that might be something that you would aspire to. That's something that occurred to both of us. But I would say that the best job I ever had was the job as a county agent, whether it be in St. Helens, needing a lot of help, Gillam County, in the Dalles, Wasco County, or overseas. Those were just the best times that, you know, as far as personal satisfaction. Becoming an administrator, I remember the director asking me what would make me happy as an administrator. How would I get my accolades? Mm-hmm. You get a lot of accolades out in the county from somebody saying, gee, you did a great job. You know, you saved us $8 million, whatever the case may be. You know you did a good job. You know, for a lot of reasons, you can see what you've done and what effect you had. But it's a lot more difficult in administration, as you well may know, when you have to evaluate people, et cetera. And so I just would say that as far as an extension position, probably this is true anywhere in the United States, the best position, the most satisfying position would be the county position, particularly if, you know, you have any people skills at all and you're happy in the work, why, that was the best job. As far as changes that I see...
Hold on just a minute. Go ahead. You had mentioned at one time you said the job as a county faculty, and another time you said county agent. Yeah.
Same thing.
Why are there two different...
Well, I changed those, and we changed those when we started as associate directors. If we're going to call people faculty here on campus, let's call them faculty in the county. And so if this is history, in the 60s, they were county agents. They still were faculty members. They've always been faculty members. I think this has been one thing that's unique about Oregon State University as compared to a lot of other land-grant universities that have the extension service. They're not recognized as, quote, faculty members. They're classified staff or another type, but not faculty. So all of our extension agents are faculty in the counties. And I think that was a very good thing. That surprised a number of people. When I was overseas, like the head of Rockefeller Foundation, whom I worked with over there, said, I don't understand this. How can you be a faculty member if you're just an extension agent? I says, because the university recognizes us as faculty members, and we have the responsibility to... perform like a faculty member, only in a different way. Why can't that happen? He didn't really have a response to that because he didn't know, but that is kind of unheard of in the United States. So that was, I think that was one of the good things that we have and had going.
Mm-hmm. Let me fill in, maybe helps a little bit, Elizabeth. When we were hired with bachelor's degrees, our title or our rating was an instructor in the university faculty system. Then when we got our master's degrees, or actually you could get an assistant professor without it, about the time we both got our master's degrees, and Tom's timing might have been different than mine, but I was promoted to assistant professor while I was in graduate school. Just happened to me. Mm-hmm. And then later I made an associate professor, and it seemed like it took a little while, but later I became a full professor and retired as an emeritus faculty with a full professor rating. Mm-hmm. Tommy's happened probably a little bit different in sequence, but that is unique that county agents could become full professors and recognized within the university system as full-fledged full professor faculty if they reach that status.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very good point. And I think when we... As the university progressed or got to know extension and found out we were faculty members and had been, then there was criteria set up so that, you know, we had to conform to be able to, if we were going to be promoted to not just tenure, but associate or assistant associate professorship, there are things you had to do. Scholarly activity was one of them, teaching, research, scholarly activity. which Extension does, but it's was set up to where there was criteria that said this is what scholarly activity is for Extension mm-hmm. faculty. It's not the same as on campus. It can't be the same because mm-hmm. you're teaching or doing research. We're teaching, but we're not necessarily doing research in the counties. There's a lot of faculty that don't do research mm-hmm. in the counties. In fact, few do. Well, there are probably more now. But and then they had a requirement finally to that faculty had to be at least have a master's degree. And then we put that in our plan where we required, we didn't recruit anybody unless they had a master's degree. Mm-hmm. We all were grandfathered in, but ultimately most of us kind of were informed that if you want to go up the promotion ladder in this organization, you better get your master's degree sometime along the way, which we did. Everybody now, I think, pretty much has them. Mm-hmm.
In fact, people with doctorates get hired as county agents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Extension, you mentioned, changed. Well, I think in the 60s, 70s, 80s, in the 90s, I think in the 90s, Extension began to change. The university made some major change, I think, in directing finances. For 30, 40 years, maybe 50, 100, the legislature provided us with a budget, and the federal government. It used to be that the federal government's budget was more than what the state budget was for years, and then that changed and switched. The budgets, the money went into Extension Fund, a state fund for Extension, separate fund, not within the university system. Still is, I think, a separate fund. But what a major change was that I think that Extension, that affects Extension is that the last 10 years, the funds that went for Extension went to the deans as opposed to the Extension director. Heretofore, the director and the administrative team supervisors had control of the Extension funds. They provided salaries for faculty, staff, support staff for on-campus and off-campus positions. And the county offices also provided funds for off-county, and that still is occurring. And we had a president that initially said that if we don't have support, it's a three-legged milk stool. We have support from the federal government, from the state, and if we don't have support for the county, from the county, we don't have faculty in the county. Mm-hmm. So that's why we established a number of taxing service districts so we could have support, so the counties could support. And we nearly pulled Extension out of some counties, and I think Multnomah County now is an example. They're trying to get back in. Before I retired, we had Extension staff in every county, and they were supported. Mm-hmm. But the general fund money that goes now, instead of going into the director's budget, so to speak, then is funneled out to the deans, and then the deans funnel that to the various department heads. So control is by the deans, basically, and department heads. And so I think you have a different kind of extension because it's pretty easy to support programs on campus, and when you're a dean and you don't get out a lot, or you don't know what's going on in Oregon, and of course I'll be challenged over that. I've said that at times, sometimes in budgeting, the closest to reality that some of the deans have is going to Safeway here in Corvallis, mm-hmm. that they really don't get out, they really don't understand what's going on in Fossil. Mm-hmm. Heard of Fossil, but have never been there, don't understand what it's like living there, and the kind of support base that you need. So I have seen a shift of funds from the county level to the state level. And what does that do to the faculty in the county? I don't know because I've been retired too long. Mm-hmm. But I see that as a shift, and I believe that Extension is not the same as it used to be. I'm not saying that this isn't as good. I'm just saying that I don't see the support in the field. I don't hear about the support from the people that we used to have for our faculty in the field. Mm-hmm. So I think that has had an effect. Now, whether we will ultimately have deans that really recognize that the whole state is something that they ought to look at a little more seriously than just on campus and worrying about, say, a secretary's position on campus or an FTE, I don't know. I don't know what will happen. Mm-hmm. But having had the experience, and I think we're better off having had the experience as county agents. I think anybody is, to come from a county agent and then go into administration. Mm-hmm. And particularly when you're working with county faculty, you're working with county courts, you've been there, you've done that, you've gone through the throes, as opposed to hiring somebody who comes from another campus, has never been an extension agent, has never had to work in the field, understands what it's like. I just think you can be so much more effective to the county faculty if you've had that experience. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'd be as effective if you just had county experience in working with on-campus faculty or specialists. You probably wouldn't be as effective. I mean, the same scenario, same mm-hmm. case, had you been a specialist or so. Mm-hmm. Originally, I think, our specialists were designed to support the county staff, in education and help mm-hmm. them. That was their primary responsibility. What the specialists do now, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. Mm-hmm. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. One of the changes that I don't feel comfortable evaluating is that those county faculty are now considered faculty members of the horticulture department or the crop science department. How often they get on campus and how much they have to say about what goes on in that department, I'm just not qualified to judge. But that is a change which could be positive because... Mm-hmm. Under our system, the county agent had tenure in extension service, not in a department. And that could be positive, but I just don't know whether it is or not.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you did a survey of county faculty and if they were honest how they would feel about that. Probably some of the faculty who had experienced a different form of administration might look at it a different way than the faculty that they've hired now and haven't mm-hmm. seen the differences between our faculty in the field. In Fossil, Oregon, answering to the crop science department or the animal science department mm-hmm. And being evaluated by the head of the Department of Animal Science. It's great if the head of the Department of Animal Science has been out there, has really gotten involved, knows the people, knows the area, and knows what mm-hmm. that person has to put up with. But you can't compare the livestock agent and what he does in Wheeler County to the livestock agent and what they might do in Umatilla County or some of the other counties that have a lot more cattle and, mm-hmm. and totally different in production. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Good question. We kind of walked around that one, didn't we?
One of the things that Tom and I both did without discussing it was when we retired, we didn't go back to Extension Hall on any kind of a regular basis. Very rarely that we go there. And we seemed to be welcome, but I think we could overstay our welcome if we mm-hmm. stayed too long. So when we got out, we got out. We didn't try to have any influence on what was happening or on the people that replaced us. We just said, okay, we did our 30 years, it's somebody else's turn.
Do you keep in touch with Alberta and some of the other folks?
Yeah, I see Alberta a little bit. Harold plays bridge with her a lot. I get on campus once or twice a year, maybe. Is about all. If that, really. When I retired, I can remember the first day, I mean, it was in November, and... Fortunately, there was hunting season, so that kept me occupied. But after that, for about 2 weeks, I wondered what I was going to do because mm-hmm. it wasn't getting up and, charging over the mountain and solving some big personnel issue or doing this or doing that. So I thought, my gosh, I probably got to start taking up golf or doing something. And then in about 2 weeks, I got over that. I did go down to campus two or three times. And then after I got over that and got to puttering around and found stuff to do, there was about 3 or 4 years I hadn't been on campus, period.
Mm.
But like Harold, we just kind of agreed that, you know, we had met a lot of people that retired, and they'd come in and they'd visit with you and just want to talk about old times, and you felt pressed for time, and I said, I'm not going to do that to any faculty.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their jobs to do. And, you know, retirement is for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Elizabeth, one point I was going to mention, I forgot it, was when that one other thing Frank Ballard said to me early in my career was, Harold, if you ever get confused, your work week starts every Monday morning at 8. And I didn't really know what that meant till after about 6 months in Prineville, and I realized if you work Saturday and Sunday, yeah, Monday morning at 8 was a new week.
Yeah.
And so he didn't say you had to work 7 days a week, but he implied it might happen. Mm-hmm. And in those days, Saturday morning was part of the work week.
Yeah. You were expected to work till noon on Saturday.
Yeah.
And I had, as a 4-H agent, I didn't have very many things scheduled Saturday morning, but Saturday afternoon we might have a 4-H activity. And my staff chairman let me know that I need to be in the office Saturday morning, and then I could go out to my 4-H function Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
And a Sunday night meeting might happen too, and I just accepted that as a fact.
Yeah.
Well, as supervisors, we ran into the new faculty that we are hiring, and they had a little different concept of what a work week was. And I had a little problem with that through the years, because I really couldn't say to them, your work week starts Monday morning at 8. I also didn't go along with the idea if you had a 4-hour meeting Wednesday night, you didn't have to come in till noon on Thursday morning. I never would accept that. But some people saw that as what was appropriate work. If you worked overtime Wednesday night, you didn't have to be there Thursday morning. But that was always a little bit of a controversy for me and for some of my faculty that I supervised.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my approach was that you're getting, you know, you're on a monthly salary, and you do the job. You got the job to do, you get the job done. Get her done. If it takes Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we've all done that. Take Saturday and Sunday. If you and your wife have to go to town, you need to go to the doctor, you go to the doctor. You don't have a meeting or something, you go to the doctor. But you get your job done,
mm-hmm.
whatever that takes. And don't worry about whether you need to take 4 hours off because you work 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You just get the job done, and whatever else you got to do. You got 30 days of vacation. And you know, if you want to take off and go fishing, and you want to take off on Friday afternoon or Friday morning, and you got your work done, get out of here.
That's fine.
And that seemed to appease most people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 4-H agents, I think, probably were the hardest hit of our faculty, because when you had fairs and 4-H meetings, they were in the evenings. You had fair board meetings that they had to go to. And then the fair was a grueling 24/7 all the time. Then right after the fair, you had all these people that were angry because their kid didn't win the prize. And so you had to, you know, solve all these issues mm-hmm. with the 4-H leaders. And so, you know, you were going to meetings on Wednesday and Thursday, and you tell your wife, oh, I got a fair board meeting. Oh, I got a 4-H leaders meeting. Well, something come up, and we've got a club over here that's very unhappy. So they had a lot of night meetings, a lot of Saturday meetings and mm-hmm. Sunday meetings. I always, you know, when I found that out when I was in Condon, how many weekends and hours that the 4-H faculty worked. And, you know, there weren't a lot of complaints. And my attitude when they said, geez, I haven't had some time, I said, hey, you got your job done, get out of here. Just mm-hmm. get her done, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about that.
So before we finish here, could you talk a little bit about your retirement? What have you been doing since in the last 10, 15 years?
You know, one of the favorite things I have to say when somebody says, well, what have you been doing for retirement? I just look right at them and say, nothing.
Yeah.
I don't have now Harold's a little different than I do. I don't have a schedule. I don't have a calendar. And my wife gets on me because she says, you know, we got to go to the doctor. You got a doctor? Oh, do I? And I used to have a calendar where I knew, you know, what I had to do. But we traveled quite a little bit overseas, and then we traveled some right after we retired. My son went to school in France, and we went over there and spent some time there. And since that time, that I like to hunt and fish, and so I've done that. And other than that, I just have fun puttering around. Mm-hmm. I don't have any specific, spend a little time on the coast from time to time, but don't have anything specific that mm-hmm. that I do every day. I wake up in the morning and my wife tells me to do something, I do it. Mm-hmm. Either that or I leave for coffee with Harold and
yeah.
Well, mine's a little bit different, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. I have retired.
He has a calendar.
I still got a calendar. I retired Friday night at 5 o'clock and went to work Saturday morning at 4 a.m. at Sawbush Island Farms as a shift supervisor in the plant where they processed pumpkins and made pumpkin pie puree, frozen pumpkin pie puree. I did that from the October, November, and mid-December, 12-hour shift, 6 days a week, and nearly killed me because our other job was mostly driving or sitting at a desk, and this one was on your feet all the time on mm-hmm. concrete. But I finally got conditioned to that and to work then part-time for Stallbush Island Farms for through the next 17 years. I actually have 17 years of employment at mm-hmm. Stallbush Island Farms. Not full-time all year, but periodically. I'm now, last job I had was a security guard at the farm since 9/11, and I worked the last 3 or 4 years as a four-hour shift.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also a volunteer 4-H leader. I was a 4-H member and a 4-H agent, but I never got to be a 4-H leader, so I've completed 10 years now as a 4-H leader of a local 4-H livestock club, sheep and beef. Carol and I traveled quite a bit, did it 6 or 7 cruises through those last 17 years. And I'm active in our Kiwanis Club,
mm-hmm.
Along with a lot of other retired extension people. So I'm seriously considering cutting back some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some health issues this last 4 months, and I haven't made any commitments for 2008. Mm-hmm. I may quit working. I think I'll hang on as a 4-H leader because that's a special kind of a thing, working with mm-hmm. those kids. But I've kept pretty busy mm-hmm. through the years.
And you guys, you live, what, a mile or two from
each
other?
We live a mile or two apart. We usually have coffee once a day.
So that you see each other often.
Yeah, almost daily. Yeah.
Yeah. Both of our wives, I think, kind of enjoy that because we get out of their hair at least for a period of time.
Yeah.
And when they don't enjoy it, they let us know. I think with the women, it's kind of, if they're really glad to see us go, and then when we go, sometimes if they just want to grouse on us, and then we go too much. So,
yeah.
I've never learned over nearly 50 years what is right.
I haven't either. I played golf. I had coffee with Tommy yesterday morning, and then played golf in the afternoon. And Tommy came by to visit me, and I went there, and he and Carol talked about a lot of things, and I really don't want to know very much about what they talked about. He may have helped, and he may not have, Elizabeth.
Yeah, he called me this morning and said, I hear you visit with my wife quite a bit. I said, yeah, boy, you got your work cut out for you.
Well, are there any things I didn't ask you about or anything you'd like to ask before?
Good Lord, I don't think so.
No, I think we've covered the waterfront.
There's a lot of things we didn't tell you, but they're better unasked.
Well, if you think of more, let me know. I'll come back with the report.
Well, I'm sure Sue won't want to know. Anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure. It's been a pleasure, Elizabeth, and certainly a privilege to be asked to, to provide some input, at least for, an organization that we spend a lot of time at and love very much.
Mm-hmm.
I'd second that.
Okay. Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Good.